good day, friends and folk, wherever you are. Thank you for stopping by. I hope you are doing well today. I'm Henrik from the Land of the Geats, and this is Red Ice Radio. Today we're going to highlight the question of faith, belief, and religion or spirituality for those who are Europeans. Where do we look for our native spiritual tradition, something that can show us our ancient tribal roots? Well, we have Stephen McNallan back today to share with us his latest on Asa Tru of the Northern People of Europe. Well, Mr. McNallan has been a soldier, a journalist, a juvenile corrections officer, and a school teacher. He has traveled the world from Burma to Bosnia in search of insight and adventure. But his ultimate quest has always been spiritual. In 1971, Stephen founded the Viking Brotherhood, the first legally recognized religious organization dedicated to the gods and the goddesses of Northern Europe. Today, McNallan is the head of the Asa Tru Folk Assembly, the preeminent Asa Tru organization on the North American continent. He is a proud native Texan, but he currently resides in Northern California with his wife, Sheila. Well, today, folks, we are going to talk about his latest book. This is a really, really interesting program, so stay with us for much more. Welcome back, Stephen. It's great to speak with you again. We've done a couple of great shows together. It's always a pleasure to have you with us, so thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Henrik. I always enjoy coming on Red Ice. It's different and alive and truly, truly free inquiry, and I love that.
Thank you so much, Stephen. We discuss, as you know, many different issues, and we try to highlight that which we consider to be not only important, but very pressing in our times. And what we'll be discussing today is, of course, not any different. In fact, I think the timing is absolutely perfect. We have spoken with so many people recently who are, I guess, wondering what belief, what spirituality or religion, if one prefers that word, we are to look towards if we are to identify with something which is native to the European people. As Christianity is failing people and turning against Europeans, even Christians, both in Europe and America and around the West, the question is, where does one turn to counter liberalism or the progressive tyranny of modernity that is rising up all around us, even in the church? And, you know, I think because of that, many of us feel that we lack belonging, a sense of purpose. We don't have any deeper connection to ourselves, to our people, to nature, or to our land, for that matter. But your latest book, Stephen, Asa Tru, A Native European Spirituality, is something that I think fills this void and gives us an opportunity to reach back into our own past and link us to something which also makes us understand that we are also natives as well, and that we have a native religion, despite the fact that other people and groups have tried to claim this definition for themselves in opposition to a certain extent of who we are. But do you think it would be wise to compare us to other people and groups who hold also older beliefs that are rooted in nature and their own traditions of viewing the world, so that they can understand what we are talking about? Or is this spirituality unique? Is it unique to us?
Well, I do think we are unique, but then so are those other indigenous or native groups. I think that we do have commonalities, and we need to play on that because it's something that people have heard about and that people can understand. A few years ago, if I'd said to someone that we are tribal or that we have a tribal past, people would have looked at me in amazement, and they would never get it. I've got a shirt I wear around sometimes. And it's a lovely black shirt with a nice script on the front, and it just says tribal. And on the back, it says bound by blood. And it has a picture of various European totemic animals. You know, it has wolves and bears and such. And I'm waiting for someone to come up and ask me what tribe I'm from. And I would have to respond, well, the Cherusci, Heruli, Ordovici. And I would go through, you know, some of the European tribal names. These are our heritage. We are a tribal people. We are the descendants of men and women who lived in tribes and had their own native religion.
Yep, exactly. Very good. I mean, the question is what it means to be, or what we mean with the tribal. And this is something, of course, you address early in the book of just the terminology alone, pagan, heathen, or obviously also through itself the term, but This is something we have to understand, I guess, by using the right terms, because all of these words that are thrown around conjures up different images in people. So it's difficult to find a good name, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. Long, long ago, before I ever heard the word Ásatrú, I called myself a Norse pagan. And after that, I called myself an Odinist. And then finally, I learned a proper name for our faith in the old days. And this is not something that's easy to explain to people. The word pagan, to most people, is a derogatory term. It means typically someone who is non-religious or who is, you know, very open sometimes in their defiance of social rules and so forth. The word heathen has been adopted by many people who follow the old northern religions. But again, that is a word that has a lot of semantic baggage in our culture. You think of a heathen, you think of someone with dirty feet who doesn't have any manners and who wipes their nose on their sleeves or something. And that's unfortunate because the root of the word is good. It comes from the word heiðni in Old Norse, and it refers to, in fact, the old religion, the religion of the people out on the heath, to go to an English cognate. But today, those terms don't work well. If we're going to tell people about something that is really new for them as a religion, we might as well use a word that is accurate and doesn't have a lot of negative connotations.
Yes, exactly. And obviously, we'll get in and talk more about many of the things you talk about in the book. I just want to mention that the book really distills not only your journey, but much of the work that you've been reading and collecting over the years. And what is it, Stephen, about 40 years of just knowledge of being involved in these kinds of areas that have that is poured into this book, right?
About 45 now, yes.
Yeah. And obviously, let's talk about if this is a replacement for religion. As I said earlier, we can see that Christianity is something that obviously is not filling a role in Western society, at least anymore, as it did only 100 years ago. We might have to back up a little bit more in some countries, but nonetheless, is Ásatrú there as a religion to fill that void in your view, Stephen?
Well, it definitely is a religion, obviously, but it is also a worldview. I don't expect every person of European descent who is out there to run to join Ásatrú or something. There will always be Catholics. There will always be Protestants. There's going to be, you know, your various and sundry sects. Those aren't going to go away. No time in the conceivable future. But I compare it to the situation with the American Indians, where back on the reservation or often in the urban jungles, there are people who do practice the old ways. There are still the wise men. There are still the men who get visions. There are still those who practice the old rites. Now, your typical Sioux or Kiowa or Comanche living in an urban area, he may have any religion or no religion, but deep in his heart, he knows that those people are still there, that there is still that connection with ancient roots and ancient ways. And that makes a difference, to know that you have something that is innately yours, even if you don't practice it all the time or ever, but as still it's a reflection of who you are as a person and who your ancestors were and are as people.
So who would you say Ásatrú is for?
I think that it is essentially for people of European heritage, specifically, of course, the north of Europe. That's where it comes from. The word itself is from one of the Nordic languages. Most of our material that we have to work with is in the various Nordic languages. But we also have to remember that the Germanic tribes occupied a huge swath of Central Europe. And those tribes, not to mention the Vikings, got all over the place. I think if we look closely, I see a sort of pan-European view to a large extent. And I'm not saying that with the idea of, oh, gee, let's recruit more numbers. I'm saying it because with all of the native European religions, you have very strong parallels. You have similar mythic structure. You have similar values. particularly the Celtic and the Germanic slash Nordic belief systems are very similar. The mythologies are similar. The values are similar. There's a huge resonance there. And rather than drawing a line and saying, well, you've got to be Swedish, or, Norwegians, but in Danes, well, only if you're, you know, a ways from the border down there from Germany, you know, right. We're not doing that. It's not that way. I see it as essentially reflecting the heritage and the spirit that is accessible to European descended peoples, regardless of what part of Europe they're from and how long they've been gone from there. I mean, you certainly don't have to be living there now to still have the essence within you.
Yeah, exactly. And also you show in the book and discuss a little bit about the commonalities between other both Indo-European traditions, but also things that existed, you know, in Russia. And as you said, sure, many of the tribes, they migrated around at the time, and there's a lot of different people, but there seems to be a kind of a commonality, as we said, between many different European cultures, even though if they don't use the same names for their deities, obviously correlations is fairly easy to make, actually.
Well, they are. And one expert whose work was very influential on me, Hilda Davidson, who was a British professor. I'm sure she's long gone now, but she wrote a lot of very good books on the Northern stories and the Northern religions. And one of those books actually compared most closely the Celtic and the Germanic, again, slash Nordic, understanding that those are, you know, pretty much the same deal. And she came to the conclusion that both of these, the Celtic and the Germanic, could be considered two expressions of a common European religiosity. And I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, indeed. So this, or in this native European religion, did you feel along the way that there's somewhere you had to kind of, I don't know, fill in the blanks, or are things still so intact coming down to us from the sagas, from the material that we have available, that it has really been, your work has really been about piecing all that together?
Well, yes and no. Scholars are going to argue for the next 100 years about the details of religious practice in ancient Scandinavia or on the Germanic tribal areas on the continent or wherever. I mean, this is always something that is questioned, and there is always ambiguities. I think we have to start with the source material that makes good sense to us and that is you know, seems clear. We can then extrapolate from related spiritual paths and religions. And then from that, we can fill in with instincts because we are, after all, those people. And by doing this, I think that we can arrive at something that has the spirit of the old ways, which follows the true ideas of the old ways, and yet at the same time is customized for life in the 21st century. For example, I'm not going to go out and sacrifice a pig this Yule time because I don't live in that kind of a society. I've got meat at the grocery store. My meat comes in styrofoam. And that's not necessarily the way that I want to live, but it's what I've got and it's what the average person has. If we lived in a rural community, yes, I absolutely would. I would be out there and I would butcher a big boar for the Yule feast, and we would partake of that boar. And in doing so, we would share the might of the boar and the might of the gods, and we would share that meal with the gods themselves. But I don't live in that kind of a life.
Sometimes I wish we did, a little bit more simpler, right?
Well, there's a lot to be said for that. And yeah. I'd like to see a day when it was easier to live that kind of a self-reliant, sort of back-to-the-land kind of lifestyle. It can be done, of course, and some people do it, and I sort of totally congratulate them. But the way society is set up now, it's not really a practical option for most people. And we, I think, can adhere to the principles behind sacrifice. And I should add to your readers that the word sacrifice is a very loaded word. I know actually use that typically in referring to our rites and rituals. I use the term bloat, which is an exchange between the holy powers and ourselves. It is by no means one-sided. One can adhere to the general ideas without getting wrapped up in the mechanics of slaughtering animals in your backyard.
Right, exactly. I'll definitely want to, you know, ask you about some of those things a little bit later here. But obviously, then, it's not about kind of reinventing the wheel. It's not that we have to, kind of pull out or create a religion out of thin air and say, here's something that we can, attach ourselves to and worship or what have you. But what would you say to the question of why we need something like this today?
We need something like this today because by its very nature, it resonates with that which is deepest and most holy within us. I believe that all the major groupings of mankind have a primal religion, a native religion that specifically, we might say, co-evolved with them, and thus is ideally tuned to their evolutionary background. I believe that every native religion on the planet is the distillation of the spiritual journey of that people, specifically that people, from the earliest possible times. And that in today's age, they can be Catholics or Protestants or Buddhists, or they can go to shamanic circles on the weekends or whatever. But all of that is outer. All of that is appearance. All of that is something that they put onto what they are. The essence of what they are is what their ancestors did. Those are the people whose voices speak inside them. And it is to those gods and to that inner world, that spiritual world, that they ultimately resonate. And when we are divorced from that, we suffer.
Yes. We certainly do. And I don't know if you have them ready and handy there, Stephen, but in the beginning of the book, you describe obviously what Ossatru is like, and also what it feels like, I guess, as a religion. And you break down a couple of things in terms of trying to convey the attitude and the essence of these beliefs. Is there some of these that you can go through for us?
Well, Henrik, I don't actually have those sitting in front of me on a list, but I think I can come up with most of them right off the top of my head because they are so natural and so, I think, understandable. One thing we believe is that we don't need to be saved. We do not need salvation. What we need is the opportunity to live as free men and women. We believe that holiness is not something that depends on a hands down from a deity on a mountain, but rather comes from the nobility of men and women. We believe that our relationship with the holy powers, or the gods and goddesses, if you want to call them that, is not one of a master-slave relationship. We see the holy powers as our kin and as our friends, and we treat them in that respect in regards to our ritual work. Basically, we believe that we are a certain way, and that way is not the way that is depicted in the Abrahamic religions and so forth. We believe that we are born free, and we are here to work our destiny, to carry out our duty, and to lead lives of nobility and purpose.
I like the way you open up the book as well, and also kind of discuss some of the aspects of what Ossatru can offer people today, and the very idea that it has answers for us, and it gives us connections to something deeper. And I mean, I can't more than agree in terms of saying that this is something which so many people today suffer from. I mean, we have been, I don't know if it's correct to say that science has disconnected us, because to a certain extent, as you discuss in the book as well, science has actually, although it's given us a lot of answers, the further we push in that direction, it also gives us a lot of uncertainty, which to a certain extent seems to kind of meet up, if you will, of where we can find something like Ossatru that to kind of connect us to a spiritual life. Would you agree?
Well, yes, I would. And in fact, I think the word that you've used at least twice in the last few seconds, connection or connectiveness, derivations of that, I think that's the essence of what it's all about. You know, the word religion comes from Latin roots, meaning, you know, linking or to link to and that sort of a thing. And I think that connections is what religion and Ausatru in particular is all about. I would ask your listeners to imagine a figure suspended in space, human figure, you know, one of those Da Vinci looking drawings, you know, the Vitruvian man or whatever.
Yeah.
And let's analyze some of these connections for just a moment. Behind us, we have all of our ancestors. In front of us, we have our descendants yet to come. Off our left and right sides, we have our living kin who are with us now. Above us, we have the holy powers. And below us, we have the earth and the world of nature. In each of those directions, we have connections. In each of those directions, we have responsibilities. And from each of those directions, we in turn receive blessings of various kinds. Ausatru is all about connections. It's connections with our ancestors. It's responsibilities to those descendants that will have to live in this world after we're gone. It's our links with our living blood kin all around the world. It's our connection with the holy powers above. And that relationship, remember, is one of friendship and one of kinship. And always, always our connection with the earth. We are rooted in the earth. And we are a part of nature and subject to the same laws as every living thing on the planet. Ausatru is about connections.
So it's something real, obviously, that we can connect and I guess call on those who've gone before us in a certain way. And also maybe to a certain extent, this is in the same function that you can connect with the gods and the goddesses that exist within that. Maybe there's a distinction, you can tell us more about that, but the gods, to a certain extent, is part of our ancestry, but obviously they're not our immediate, grandparent or whoever has maybe recently passed away, etc. But there, in your view, there's different ways that we can connect with these, and we can call on them, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Just to take our ancestors for a moment. People think of death as a brick wall. I don't. I think it's a flimsy veil. And that between that veil, energy, love, care, concern, inspiration, all can move through sort of a semi-permeable membrane. You think of it that way. Some guys did a study once, and they said that more than half of men and women who had recently had someone close to them die. More than half of those people later in the weeks, the months after that, had some sort of an experience where they strongly felt that person's presence. And of course, the scientists, their question was, well, why do people have this hallucination? But my take is it's not a hallucination. And I've had personal experiences like that, and I bet that many of your listeners have, sensing the presence of a relative that has recently died, in many cases even intuiting their death without having been, you know, informed of it by the official channels like telephone calls and so forth.
Yeah.
We are connected. We're connected with our kin, and when our kin pass out of this world, we're still connected to them. And exactly what that is like, obviously, I don't know because I haven't been there on the other side. But there is that connection, and we must remember that native cultures everywhere still count the ancestors as part of the community. We have our responsibilities to the ancestors, and most especially our responsibility is to remember them, to tell their stories, to honor them, to remember their birthdays, to take our children to visit the graves. And we have our gifts that we get from them as well. Inspiration, reminders of love, that subtle intuition that gets you through a tough spot sometimes. There's a real transfer there. Similarly with the gods and the goddesses. We are blood kin to the gods in a metaphorical sort of sense. There's the story of where Heimdall, under the name of Rig, travels among humans. And essentially, he goes from farmstead to farmstead, and he ends up, you know, impregnating the women in each of these different three farmsteads. And this can be seen as a myth of the creation of social classes. And I'm sure that to that extent, that's what it is. But the implication of it is that we all have that divine spark within us. We are kin to the gods. I don't think that was a literal story with, you know, aliens from outer space or, you know, gods straight out of the myth books, you know, moving among humans. But I think that it's our way of understanding that we are kin to the gods. We share that same essence as the gods to a drastically lesser magnitude. But we are still connected with them. We're not their slaves and we're not their creations. We don't belong to them.
Yeah, it's something which is has been for a long time very, very foreign to us. And I'm, you know, we've been discussing on many shows as of late as well of how we kind of lost our way in that, no matter if we like that or not, but the religion that we have had for the, well, in some areas, the last 1,300 years, in some other areas, almost 2,000 years, is something that was not part of our inherent native spirituality. Not only imported, it was enforced in many cases as well. And I know you touch upon this in the book, obviously, and talk about the with the violence and with the ferociousness that this came into many different areas in Europe. And one of the reasons, of course, why we still have the sagas coming out of the Norse world is that we had the Christianization occurred so late. So. Many of them, there was still an opportunity to write them down or whatnot. But do you want to tell us a little bit about how this is, you know, the Christianity that we've had for a long time is not something that is that sprung up naturally, I guess, and that the way we had prior has basically been pushed out, and in some cases with extreme bloodshed and extreme ferocious attitudes from a top down rule by the king in many cases.
Yes, that's true. Essentially, there was a 1,000-year war from the Mediterranean all the way up to the Baltic, starting in about 300-something, 300 AD something. You have Constantine coming to power in Rome and enforcing Christianity there, again, with bloodshed. And the Romans in that area there were forcibly converted to Christian belief. And you had the attempts to bring the various Germanic tribes in, and that was sort of a on-again, off-again kind of thing. And then finally up in the north, you know, you had the Viking lands, and I guess Sweden was just about the last to go, with the exception of some of the areas over around the Baltic that actually held out, even officially, were only Christianized, say, you know, in the 1300s, and unofficially, it never really took. But the strategy that was used had to vary because their first attempts didn't work. The Christians originally came in with their missionaries and tried speaking to the common people. The missionaries were welcome. Polytheists are generally rather tolerant because, after all, they believe in multiple deities, so let's might as well hear what the other fellow has to say. But the common people wouldn't have it, and they wouldn't have it because the Christianity that was portrayed to them was pretty much straight out of the standard interpretation of the Bible, and it was decidedly non-heroic. There was nothing about it that matched the Germanic tribal values of courage and honor and of, all the glorious things that we find in the old sagas and in the old tribal histories. So they fell back and reconsidered and came up with another strategy, which was to go into the areas, to approach the leaders, to approach the chieftains, and to point out to the chieftains the economic value of being able to trade with Christendom, and the political power that came with the idea of divine right of kings, which was not a pagan concept. strictly a Christian concept that came in. And whereas in the old days, it had been, in fact, a duty to kind of keep the chieftains in line and to not let them violate the rights of the freemen. After Christianity came into the area, the chieftains had a lot more political power. So this was very attractive to those who wanted to gain power. And that's basically how Europe came to be Christianized, was by co-opting the leadership.
Yeah, I was reading more about Norway's king there, Olav Tryggvason, today, and the way that he took care of some of the seder, some of the seers, if you will, and tied them up and in excruciating deaths and long drawn out drowning procedures and whatnot. And remarkable, if you go to Norway today, up to Trondheim, the one you see on a pedestal high up is that same king. And it's strange to recognize or to realize that a king of the same people would do something like this. And I've always wondered what made them convert. And maybe it was for political reasons. Maybe there were certain advantages that was given to them, I guess, by other Christianized countries further down in Southern Europe. Perhaps we could speculate forever about that, huh?
Yes. Essentially, if your country became Christianized, it was like joining the economic union, the European Union or something like that. You had trade benefits and you had official recognition, and you could hang out with the emperors and the people of grandeur and power. But it meant turning your back in many cases on your own people, which of course is what some of those guys did. They basically were quite willing to torture and to forcefully repress their own people in order to gain these advantages for themselves.
Do you think that religious warfare was something that was common prior to monotheism?
No, I don't think it was very common at all. With polytheism, you've got kind of a flexible system right off. Even in the old days, there was not like one organized, formalized religious belief that was held in all areas. One valley, the people there might be really, really fond of Thor and would make their primary religious observances maybe regarding him. But over on the coast, they were more interested in Njörð or Aegir and Ran, some of these deities associated with the sea. And so that they had the prominence over there. It doesn't mean that they didn't believe in Thor. Didn't mean that they didn't like Thor, but they had different needs. They had different attitudes. They made their living a different way. And so there was not a enforced uniformity at all. There was flexibility. And that kind of flexibility makes it a lot more difficult to get people riled up and say, well, let's go over to the next valley and do something bad to them, because obviously they're doing it wrong. And there wasn't an idea of Satan or any of that. So you couldn't say, well, the other guy's a devil worshiper. So you kind of run out of options pretty quickly. And I think you'll find that religious intolerance is generally found, I won't say exclusively found, but certainly generally found amongst the Abrahamic faiths. And they've all done it. They've all done it. Christianity, yes, certainly. Christianity did horrible things to our own ancestors. The Hebrews in the Old Testament, go into this land and that land, kill anything that moves, And today, ISIS, need I say more?
Right, yep. I know. And in some cases, of course, they do it towards the other religion. It might be that they're viewed as infidels or heathens or whatever. But in some cases, of course, it's internally. And we know that in Christianity, too. But in the Islamic world, you have the Shia and the Sunni fighting. And, we, of course, have the Protestant and the Catholics. I don't know if something similar exists within Judaism. I guess it would be maybe the more Orthodox and then another more modern Reformed branch or something. But it's so divisive. It keeps us fighting forever with each other, because the other guy is always going to be wrong.
Yes. Yes, that's pretty much it. I think that the old polytheisms were much more tolerant in regards to religion. And Actually, if you compare the political views under polytheism with what things were like in Europe after Christianization, you see a real contrast as well. Women in pre-Christian times had a great deal of freedom. They could make their own contracts. They could do most of the things that men could do. They could divorce their husbands. They had a lot in the way of rights. They were highly respected. Possibly this comes from the fact that there were goddesses as role models in the pantheon. And in Christianity, that completely changed. Women's rights shrank. And I mentioned a few minutes ago about the divine right of kings, which was a Christian concept. Until that time, the rulers had been kept in check by the common folk. In fact, if you look at the old Germanic tribal structure, and it obviously this varied from century to century and location to location, but sort of a generalized model of the Germanic tribe consisted of three parts. Up at the top, you typically, but not always, had a chief. Some tribes only elected a chief when they had to go to war. So there was, a lot of variability there. A second component of the classical Germanic tribal model was sort of a body of the leading men, so to speak. I hesitate to say aristocrats, but, the people of influence and who are highly respected. And then the third component was the assembly of freemen who voted in the thing, which of course was the legislative body. So in effect, what you have is exactly parallel to the Constitution of the United States, with the executive branch and the judicial branch and the legislative branch. The parallels are really, really quite interesting, and they serve similar functions. The various portions checking against the other, and keeping the other part into some sort of control, so that no one influence in the tribe could become all powerful. Something we could maybe relearn today.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, that comes out of the Anglo-Saxon world, which is interesting then, because it gleans from this kind of Germanic tribal past, if you will. But my God, what a detour to take, and how many hundreds of years it took for this to come back into the world again. And despite what some people say that Christianity civilized us, etc., we were barbarians. It's when you look at the facts, it just doesn't hold up, does it?
No, it's absolutely false. Quite the reverse. Christianity destroyed the bonds of kinship, destroyed the importance of the blood tie. It fought against the extended families that so many people lived in. The church had to have the church and the king, which often were more or less synonymous, had to have first authority. It had to be the first loyalty of every person. And in the old days, that was not the case. Society was a bunch of concentric circles, with your close kin here in the middle, and then your extended kin, and your tribe, whatever form that might take, and so forth. Whereas when Christianity came in, it was much more centralized. All power went to the top. The executive branch, so to speak, became all powerful. And I'll bite my tongue so as not to make any comparisons with the United States today.
Yeah, exactly. Because, well, we of course ebb and flow, I guess, to a certain extent in level of freedom, I guess, and it's true for every society, but it seems the stability was certainly there a long time before Christianity came in, to a certain extent. Sure, there were as we've said, kind of warring tribes with each other, but maybe not on the practice that we needed to take over each other or run each other's lives, or maybe on a religious basis say, those guys are evil and therefore they need to be taken down. Much more in tune with nature, in other words. Things ebbed and flow, sure, but not this kind of centralization push that we've seen consequently.
Yes, and there were no heretics. Christianity made a big deal of that. In the Balkans today, you have the idea that, does one make the sign of the cross with two fingers or three fingers? And that became an issue worth killing people over. Just not that many years ago, actually.
Wow, I did not know that that aspect of it. Yeah,
yeah,
it's interesting. Now let's get into a little bit more. There's so many aspects, of course, in the book, and maybe you can just tell us a little bit why you wanted to write the book as well, Stephen. And do you feel that there was a need for much of this material to kind of come together in this kind of condensed way for people to get a better grasp fairly easy of the concept? Because of course it's not, I mean, it's based on academic work, so don't get me wrong, but it's not targeting learning specifics about Germanic words and things like this. It's targeted towards the layman, the everyday person who's looking for something deeper, right?
Exactly. It's a tool for ordinary people. It's a tool for ordinary people, and actually, yeah, anyone I think could benefit from the lessons therein. But specifically for people of European heritage, it's a roadmap back to our native way. It's a guide to reclaiming something that we had, and which is actually an integral part of us, and acknowledging that and gaining from it, getting advice on how to live your life, how to get along with people, what is honorable conduct. What should we try to do with our lives? What's the purpose of life? What's our attitudes towards the holy? What's our attitudes towards our neighbors? What's our attitude towards the earth? It's a practical handbook, really. It's not an academic piece. I've tried to stay within the realms of academia. I've got a rather lengthy glossary in the back for people that get overwhelmed by the names of deities they never heard of before or whatever. And it's lightly footnoted, but they're all relevant. And generally the footnotes are maybe recommending a reading here or a reading there or a book over yonder or whatever. And I've written millions of words, I'm sure, over the past 40 years. And most of them appeared in little periodicals or little pamphlets. Sometimes I wrote for magazines, often on subjects that really had nothing to do with Ausatru, but other matters as well. And this was my first attempt to draw all of that together into one coherent place, one consistent piece that people could use to make their lives better and to get answers about the big questions.
Very good. We'll speak a little bit more here in a little bit about where people can get the book, of course. But let's talk a little bit more about, I really like the fifth, I like all the chapters, but we can spend a little time talking about the fifth, maybe the gods as kin and friends. That is a concept which is very foreign to us. If people have a Christian background specifically, or Islam or Judaism, what have you, but this idea that we look down when we speak to God, or we clasp our hands together, we cast our head down, if you will. It's not. That's a very different way from what Ausatru is, where it's more the gods and the goddesses are seen as kin and friends, basically. Tell us more about that.
Well, I mentioned the kinship part earlier when I explained how, in my view, we have the divine spark within us. We are descendants of our gods in many ways, mythically speaking, most definitely. They are a part of our integral being. And as far as being our friends, we have countless saga references to how a person was Thor's friend or Freyr's friend or whatever the deity might have been. There was clearly a familiarity, a friendship relationship. It was not a master-slave relationship at all. And this has a lot of implications politically and socially in many respects, but also it affects the way we conduct our religion. We treat the gods and goddesses as our friends and our kin. And in Germanic society, it was customary to give gifts to your friends and to do good things for your friends. You weren't giving them gifts so that they wouldn't smite you with thunder and lightning. You were giving them gifts because that's what friends do. There's an old poem called the Haufamal in the Eddas, which is our accumulated, I guess you could say, our sacred text. And it's a lot of it is sage advice for a good life. It's very, very simple, almost proverb-like, little short verses and explaining, you know, how to get along with people, what is prudent behavior, what are good things to do to ensure that your life goes okay. Sort of basic rules of conduct and common sense. And many of these verses deal with the giving of gifts. It was a very Germanic thing to do, to give gifts to each other. They were, you know, you would get someone, a sword or an arm ring or a fine article of clothing, or on the level of the peasants, you know, with half a loaf of bread and a cup. I won many a friend. You know, there's all sorts of levels on which that operates. So we treat the holy powers that way. In our rites, when we give gifts to the gods, we don't give them, sacrificed slaves or, dead chipmunks or, or money or things like that. The gods don't need that. What the gods need is our support, our loyalty, our supporting them and standing with them in the same way that our friends do. This is something friends need. And much like our ancestors, one of our primary obligations to the holy powers is to remember them, to honor them, to keep those connections fresh. So it's an entirely different approach to that sort of thing. In the Abrahamic religions, you have God the Father, but he's a dysfunctional father. He does horrible things to his kids. You have the flood where he wipes out almost all of humanity and then saves a handful of people and basically warns them, well, next time I'm going to burn you. That's crazy. That's lunatic. This is an insane deity in many ways.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're about. Our gods are not angry fathers. Now, it's true, in the New Testament, you have Jesus. Jesus is a much gentler character, but he's most commonly characterized as a shepherd, which makes us sheep. And I'm not sure that that's such a good comparison either. We're not sheep, and we're not the offspring of maniac divine parents. We are friends to the gods and kin to the gods. And our duty is not to worship them and beg their favor or to humble ourselves before them. Our job is to become more like them. I think the holy powers want us to evolve. They want us to grow. They're not standing over us with a rod ready to smite us. They're in front of us and they're beckoning to us, saying, come on, you can do it. You know, be more like us, be stronger, be wiser. You know, be more prosperous, live life more fully. And I think that's a better relationship.
Oh, yeah. And it's one we need right now, too, isn't it? I mean, in terms of not only self-esteem and good role models, but just a sense of achievement. Because at least I personally feel, Stephen, that so much has kind of deteriorated into mediocrity and a kind of a victimhood. And, you have these kind of different classifications of how victimized you are, and therefore how much you can be pitied in society. Almost, it's very antithetical to the way of the Norse people and Europeans overall, I feel.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's no room for self-pity. There's no room for a culture of weakness. There's no room for a culture of helplessness. We saw a lot of this stuff kind of starting up in the 60s and 70s. All of your characters in the movies back in those decades, there were more anti-heroes than heroes.
Yep.
Remember
there
was that whole period there, especially in, I guess, about the 70s, when everything was loaded with that. And today we still get the victim mentality. Well, no, we're not victims. We have power over our lives. If we're not getting what we want, then we need to try harder. We need to learn more. We need to become wiser. We need to try a different approach. We don't ask our gods for handouts. And we don't ask each other for handouts. You help kin. You help friends. You do those things. But you're expected to be self-reliant as possible, to do your own part. And ideally, to strive towards a true nobility of character, to be that hero, character that you find in the sagas.
Yes, and we need to fight. It's also through trials and hardship that we advance, and this is something which is incorporated into the sagas and into the belief itself that it's as you say, it's not, you know, if we want to grow, it's not, it takes many different facets, and it's an appreciation of the trials that we might go through, and this is something which rises us to a new level, to then to a certain degree become more, and I don't know if this is despised within Christianity among other things, but to become more like the gods, right?
Exactly. We are not mere dust beneath the chariot wheels of Yahweh, or whatever that line out of the Bible is. We are aware beings with the divine spark within us, and we need to realize that and to strive upwards. And strive, yes, it is striving, because it is a struggle. Growth is painful, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it.
Absolutely. Now, let's just talk a little bit more about the book here and where people can get copies of it as the time of this recording, when this recording occurs. Pre-orders, of course, are available. It's going to be out about a week from now when we're doing this recording here. But give us all the websites, Stephen, before we take a break here. And anything else you might want to mention about the book? Obviously, we'll get more into it in the second as well. But yeah, please go ahead.
Well, of course, the Asatru Folk Assemblies website is runestone, runestone.org. And you can find us on Facebook. You can find my personal page on Facebook. And I'd be glad to like any of your readers that would like to, or listeners, excuse me, that would like to drop in. I've got an author's Facebook page. I do a lot of stuff on Facebook. I've got a Green Asatru Facebook page as well that deals entirely with the environmental issues. And one thing I'm involved in that is not really connected with Asatru at all, but it's an essential part of what I am, is an anti-elephant poaching initiative that I have underway. And so your listeners might want to drop into Forever Elephants on Facebook. And of course, if they go to Amazon and search under my last name and the word Asatru, they're going to find that new book that can soon be in their hands.
Very good. Exactly. We're going to have that obviously linked up as well. Asatru, a native European spirituality. It's available on Amazon right now, and of course, we'll have all the links up as well. But check out runestone.org. There's a lot of good stuff on the website for those who want to know more about this, either if you're new to it or if you want to, if you've already been into it for a long time. This is something which I feel strongly about, that this is something that we need to reawaken, to kind of regain our footing to a certain extent in these uncertain times when everything around us seems to be faltering. It's not just the idea of trying to cling on to something or cling on to religion because it's what we need. It's not about that either. I think it's deeper than that, just as you explained, Stephen. It's about trying to reach back into our past of something which is a part of us, to try to awaken that to a certain extent, to feel that we are we're not alone. We don't stand here on our own and without no connection to anything or to anybody, but that we have there is a strength to a certain degree. To realize the connection with our ancestors, with our past, with the gods and the goddesses, and also, of course, with our kin that are here and now. And I feel that that's something we strongly need. We need to get those networks, out there, basically, and connect with more people and try to regain some of this, which I feel has been lost, you know?
Yes, it's about connections, and it's about wholeness. It's about finding our roots again and realizing that we're not rootless, that we are not alone, that in fact we are part of a wonderful continuum of history, traditions, life, and intelligence.
Okay, runestone.org and also forevereelephants.org. Maybe we'll get a chance to speak more about that a bit later, both the environment, but also how it relates to what we're talking about with resource depletion and what is happening with us being caretakers of the animal world and have a healthy, balanced relationship to nature. But just one more thing here before we take a pause and pick up in the second hour. I know that you've been working hard on a new website, a new design for the AFA and with a new URL and everything. Tell us more about that.
Yes, I'm really excited about this. Our old site was, well, just exactly that. It was old, you know, and it needed a good rework. And we've got that heading towards us very soon. I would say end of the first week in June, that will be up and available for everybody. The old URL will work fine. It's just runestone.org. It will redirect to the new one. So we've got a new website, new store, new book. We've just got all sorts of new around here.
Time to reload. That's great. Do you know the URL, by the way, what that's going to be?
Yes, asatruefolkassembly.org.
There you go. Couldn't be easier. Okay, we'll have that link up as well, folks. But stay with us. Stay with us, Stephen. We'll be right back with a second hour after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, kin and folk, please stay with us in the second hour as we continue to speak more with Stephen McNallan about his latest work and the importance of this native European spirituality. We speak about the wisdom that comes to us through the sagas, but will they compare to other religious scripture? We speak about if there's anything such as commandments, which gets us into values, virtues, and ethics. We discuss how some of the deeper questions are viewed through the Norse worldview, such as what happens after we die and what is the purpose of life. We talk about Blut, Mead, burials, and of course, much more on the gods and the goddesses. We wrap up on speaking about the future of Åsatru. You can hear more at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up if you haven't already and tune in to this continuation or to any of our previous programs in full. Both hours, all of our shows going back to 2006, is available, including videos, insight episodes, films, and much more. It's only €5 per month. You can sign up for a 3-month subscription, either recurring or non-recurring. We also have 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, and 2 years available, whatever works for you. Well, folks, upcoming, we have Jim Fetzer and Ulle Damegård, Mark Hackard, Jonas Dier, Sofia Smallstorm, and many more. Stay tuned as we proceed on the other side of this break.